This is part four of our marathon interview with Ken Wilber, and in this episode, we talk about what we could call pros and cons of waking up, how to deal with nihilism and desire for certainty on the path of personal and spiritual development. You can find all of the links and show notes for this and previous episodes at futurethinkers.org/113. And to get parts one and two of this interview, go to futurethinkers.org/112. Hey, and welcome to futurethinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to futurethinkers.org/start.
So related back to the stumbling blocks, there's been a subject that's come up quite a bit in conversation between Yuvia and I related to jewels along the path to enlightenment. Or related to that, I've heard this phrase spoken over and over again: if you meet the Buddha along the path, kill him. I'd love to hear your interpretation of that, because I feel like it's very relevant in this sort of transitionary time.
Where people might be having some sort of profound experiences, and then they think they're the Messiah, and then everybody else believes them because they're so willing to give up their sovereignty to some guru.
If you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him is a very straightforward example of what we were talking about with metta. It's not this, it's not that. And when these traditions say that, they mean it. And then often the first thing that people will do is they're introspecting, and they see something like they have this amazing experience of, like, you know, illumination of infinite light. And then, whoa, and it just blows them away. And they go, oh, that's it. And if you talk to any good spiritual teacher at that point, they'll go, no, that's not it. That's something you can see. I told you, you can't see it. So if you meet the Buddha on the road and you see it, kill it, because that's not what it is. It's not an object. I don't care how much you think you've seen it. So the Christian mystics will say, if you see anything, it's an angel. It's not God. So if you see Buddha, well, it's not the seer. That's the seen Buddha. That's exactly who Buddha isn't. Just like that whole list you made of things that you are is a list of who you are not in reality. So if you put, you know, Buddha on that list, that wouldn't work either. But it's a very, it's a very real understanding. And you find somebody that the really deeply appreciated saints and sages of the traditions are ones like in Mahayana Buddhism. Well, sort of almost all of Mahayana, which is sort of the second great vehicle of Buddhism, was created by this gentleman named Nagarjuna. And Nagarjuna was working around 200 years common era. So it was about 600 to 800 years since the historical Gautama Buddha had lived. And what Nagarjuna was trying to do was really clarify and strengthen this whole notion of how pure awareness itself cannot be qualified. You really can't describe it. You can't see it as an object. And you certainly can't give it labels or names or theorize about it. And so he pretty much invented this notion of emptiness, which is at least the way it was understood from that point on. And emptiness didn't itself mean formless, or it wasn't something that you could actually qualify your awareness by saying there's this thing called emptiness and your awareness is the same as this emptiness. So in essence, what Nagarjuna did was an extremely sophisticated dialectic in a sense. But what he did was basically is, if you take any word that you want to apply to ultimate reality, that could be the good, the true, the beautiful, could be Godhead, any term you want, could be pure consciousness, pure awareness. Take any term you want, call that term X. And what Nagarjuna demonstrated is that ultimate reality is neither X nor not X, nor both, nor neither. Where does that leave you? And where it leaves you is it's almost as if, if somebody comes up and behind you and goes boo, and you kind of freeze, and there's just a few seconds where there's no thoughts, and then blah, you get flooded with adrenaline and you know what I'm saying? That 2 seconds of just pure awareness with nothing, no thoughts, no images, nothing arising, that's the type of awareness that Nagarjuna is aiming for, because that's an awareness without content. It's not just the phrase awareness without content. It's an actual awareness without content. You're actually experiencing that. It's the same way if somebody says, well, sort of the same. If somebody says, well, how do you feel from a physical point of view? Okay, how do you feel from an emotional point of view? Okay, how do you feel from a mental or psychological point of view? Okay, how do you feel from all three of those points of view? Same thing happens. You go blank for just a few seconds, and then images or stuff will start coming at you. It's those few seconds of blankness. That's what counts. Because what Nagarjuna was getting across, he actually would call that, he would use other terms, but he would explain that those terms won't work either because those are just more X terms. But that's what he called prajna, P-R-A-J-N-A. And J-N-A is the same root that we get, like gnosis, G-N-O. That's the same as J-N-A. It's also where we just get knowledge, knowledge, K-N-O. And it just means that. It means knowledge, awareness, knowing. But prajna is pro-gnosis. It's the type of awareness that actually leads to an enlightenment, leads to a waking up. And human beings have two major types of awareness. One is thought, symbols, images, impulses, and so on. And one is just pure awareness itself. But what Nagarjuna won't let people do is just try to describe that awareness and just make a description out of it. Because he's saying, no, that's just more thinking. So when you say awareness without content, that's not really awareness without content. That's just more thinking. You're just thinking that. So I'm telling you, awareness without content is X. And the awareness we want is neither X nor non-X, nor both, nor neither. And in that blankness, prajna can arise. And that's what all these meditative traditions are attempting to do, is get us out of thinking and into prognosis, into an awareness that, because if you actually get into that awareness, it doesn't have an inside or an outside. It embraces absolutely everything that's arising, and you are that. Thou art that. And that changes profoundly and forever your concept of who you are and what your true self is and what ultimate truth is. And that's what these great traditions do. And that's why it's such a catastrophe those major systems of waking up have not been included. And one of the main things that they all agree on is if you see anything, that's an angel, that's not God. If you see anything on the road, kill it, because that's not it. That's just more thinking. Buddha on the road is just saying awareness without content. So you're not experiencing that. And Nagarjuna won't accept any answer except your direct awareness of that reality. And you have to have that. That's where Zen gets all its craziness from. And that's why it's very common that you'll have a Zen koan, a Zen story, where the master will ask students a question, like, does a dog have Buddha nature? And everybody knows the correct answer is yes, but the koan here is, Josu says, no, and that's the answer. You have to figure out what the hell, why did he say no? That goes against everything Buddhism says, except Buddhism doesn't say anything technically until you have that experience. That's what Buddhism is saying. So if you think a dog has Buddha nature, you're just caught up in theory. And so Joshua loudly says, no, move. this is Japanese. And that's often a beginning koan given to students. Why did he say mu? No. That's meeting Buddha on the road. You kill it.
This is interesting. Trying to describe this thing, I know I can hear a lot of people asking the question, well, why do it? Why wake up? And in saying that, you kind of give all the reasons why not to. Like, it's a very painful process. And I'm wondering if you could expand on the pain of waking up. And then also, is it related to the typical kind of gap of nihilism between first tier and second tier consciousness? Is it somewhat the same, or are they different things, in your opinion?
Well, it's very common, the mystical traditions, to, again, talk about your relative, small, conventional, finite self, and then your real self, the true self, the real seer or witness, or your true Christ consciousness, not your individual self. And that individual self has to more or less literally die. And that's the way the traditions talk about it, is it's a death and you have to die. And so the saying is, if you die before you die, then when you die, you won't die. And that's what mystical awakening does. It when you die to the separate, isolated self, which is usually called the ego, but when you die to that separate self, you're introduced into this timeless awareness. And it's called timeless because it simply embraces past, present, and future. And this is something that's happening anyway. And I'll explain that in just a moment. But this whole notion about there being a timeless now, which is what eternity means. Eternity doesn't mean a really, really, really long time. That's how people often take it, but that's not what it means. Eternity means a moment without time. So it's a pure timeless present or timeless now. And even Ludwig Wittgenstein, Mr. Logical Positivism, he nailed it. And it's a perfect explanation. This is a direct quote from Wittgenstein. If we take eternity to mean not everlasting temporal duration, but a moment without time, then eternal life belongs to those who live in the present. So that's where you get that cliche, be here now. So here means infinity. Same with infinity as with eternity. Infinity is not a big space. It's a point without space. So 100% of infinity is right here, all of it. And eternity doesn't mean stretching out forever. It means all of eternity, 100% of it, is right now, all of it. So be here now is a sort of cliche for what you have to do to be enlightened. But the unfortunate, but well, the reason that this timeless now is an ever-present reality is that's all we're actually ever experiencing. And that's why all these traditions maintain that this separate self is actually an illusion. It's not really there. And that's the first thing you realize when you wake up to this true self. But the reason that our typical temporal stream is illusory is we never actually experience it. So you can think about anything you want to from the past right now. Just get a good image of it in your mind. And notice that you're not actually experiencing a past. That image exists right now. And that's all you're experiencing. And when it actually happened, it was right now. And the same with the future. You think about anything you want to in the future. All you're doing is you're having a present thought right now. And if that actually happens in the future, it'll be right now. The only thing you're ever aware of is right now. So all you're ever aware of is the timeless now. And so that's why even trying to just be aware of the passing present, like I won't think of yesterday, I won't think of tomorrow, just the passing present. But most traditions will tell you that's a waste of time. So it's just waking up to this realization that it's an ever-present reality, that you are always living in this timeless now and be here now in a spaceless infinity. But you get caught up in this illusory stream of time. You're always thinking about something you did wrong yesterday, always worrying about something you're going to do wrong tomorrow. So you're always facing anxiety and fear and depression. And that's the whole human condition. But we have identified with that so strongly, and we take this separate self to be so real, even though it's not any more real than actually experiencing the past or the future. We have to actually let go of that. And the problem is that turns out to be extremely hard to do. And you could be a wise ass about it and say it's a hard thing to do because you don't have to actually do it. It's an illusion. You can't get rid of something that doesn't exist. But just coming to that kind of understanding, well, again, if we just use Zen Buddhism and you give a beginning student that koan mu, you say, tell me what that means. For the average person, it's about 3 years or so before they will have that satori. So it's, and that's going to be 3 really unpleasant years. It's painful. It hurts. You're in a sense having, you have all of these buried subjective identifications, which is what really makes the egoic separate self sense crazy, because it's not just all these objects you can see that you're identifying with, like all the things you put on your list of who I am. But there's also all of these objects that are buried that you can't really see very well. And they become these sort of hidden subjects. And somehow you have to get those to become an object that you can see and therefore disidentify with. And so in the East, it's common that a religious icon is Buddha sitting in a lotus position and very peaceful and very calm and very relaxed. Well, that's after Buddha's enlightened. But in order to become enlightened, then you have the icon that's much more common in the West, and that's somebody getting crucified on a cross. And even if you're the Son of God, in reality, you still got to do that crucified on the cross thing. And that's not pleasant, and it's not. And it involves just all sorts of mental anguish, because first of all, you have to apparently learn fair bit about this. Like, what do I have to know in order to get on a path of waking up? And then the things you actually have to do, and generally speaking, you have to do some form of meditation or contemplation. There was a whole little secondary avenue that was opened in the 60s, which is very controversial, but it was psychedelics. And those, one of the reasons that those had such a big impact is in some ways they were inducing, at least in some cases, genuine mystical experiences. And the people that were studying mystical experiences and had had some themselves and then also tried something like psilocybin or mushrooms or LSD would find that some of those experiences were very, very similar to these. So that is still a possibility. They were almost totally outlawed and made in the United States what's called a Schedule I drug, which means they're treated like heroin. And so use of those just dropped off enormously. But in around the last 5 years, there are researchers that have gotten permission to research things like psilocybin. And they're finding really enormously stunning facts about what happens with that. Jordan Peterson particularly mentions one, which is as a cure for smoking, because nobody has found a good cure for smoking. None of the cures work better than 25%. But if you take a psilocybin dose and you have a mystical experience of oneness, in 80% of the cases, you stop smoking and you never start again. And Peterson is just flabbergasted by this. And he'll say such, I can't believe this, but it's true. We know it. And he's not deniable. So these are very, very interesting. If a person takes the psilocybin for smoking and they don't have a mystical experience, it doesn't work. So the mystical experience is not the same as the physiology, because they both take the same amount of drug. The physiology is identical in both of them. The upper right quadrant is identical in both of them, but the upper left is completely different. One is experienced divine oneness, a unity with the entire universe, and the other isn't. And so it's the mystical part that cures the smoking, not just the physiology part. So, but those are some apparently easier ways to get a bit of an insight into this. And a fair number at that time of well-known intellectuals like Aldous Huxley, Alan Watts, actually took at least psilocybin and wrote books about it, The Doors of Perception and so on. So I had never myself been a major fan or a user of psychedelics, but I was really, really upset when the government outlawed them, because I was most interested in them as just a tool of research. Because what those seemed to help with was this otherwise extraordinarily difficult process of what human beings have to go through in order to wake up. And without something like that sort of chemical assist, then it's still a relatively difficult process. And it is very much a type of death experience. And going through that is on this side of that experience, it's almost always fairly frightening. On the other side, it's, you know, pretty amazing and even blissful. But otherwise, it can be extremely painful and difficult path, and particularly a lot of the traditional paths of things like Zen or Christian mystical contemplation or Kabbalah. These are rocky, rocky roads. Every culture that has them maintains that they do represent ultimate truth. And so if you want ultimate truth, you are going to have to die. And you can either wait till you actually die, or you can die before you die. And we recommend you die before you die.
The brand new Future Thinkers members portal is now live. Develop your sovereignty and self-knowledge with our in-depth courses, get access to our weekly sense-making calls, join the Q&As with past podcast guests, and much more. Become a Future Thinkers member today at futurethinkers.org/members. To stay up to date with new episodes, subscribe to Future Thinkers on your favorite platform. And leave us a review or a like. It really helps out the show. And don't forget to share this episode on social media. I wanted to pick apart one thing, because there seems to be a lot of confusion with people thinking that ego death is somehow a permanent thing. Like, if you experience an ego death, then you're permanently free from ego, and therefore you're somehow perfect. So can you dig into that?
Yeah. Well, that's, to give just a quick short answer, that's just not true. One of the things that happens is that most people, well, about 60% of the American population reports that they have had some sort of mystical oneness experience. So it's a relatively common experience. And most people, including many, many people that have had an experience where they felt like they were one with everything, and that this was somehow related to Christ. They were having kind of Christ consciousness experience. Or if some Sufis have an experience, they think they're experiencing Allah or something along those lines. In many of those cases, they simply have one of these major experiences, and those are definitely life-changing. They're very profound, and they have an extraordinary impact on people. And many people will just tend, because they only have that one-time experience, then they tend to think of that as, well, that's sort of, that's it. You know, I've had the experience, I've seen it, I know what it is, there's nothing else there. And what it turns out is that if you actually look at the traditions that do these practices on a day-to-day basis, and then often with, you know, week-long retreats, month-long retreats, sometimes even, you know, for 2 or 3 years, those traditions all recognize, in essence, a kind of gradation of enlightenment experiences. And indeed, the first one is often taken to be major. So in Zen Buddhism, having that first satori, that first kensho, that's taken to be a very, very, very important turning stone in your life. And your practice sort of changes after that. Because what you're attempting to do at that point is you've had this satori experience, and often that's lasted, it could be fairly quick. You could actually be in that state for a minute or two, or maybe in some cases it could last an hour or two. In some cases, it would last a day or two. But in virtually all cases, that direct experience will tend to die off. Now, what you'll carry with you is often just a profound memory of that state. And there will be changes made. I mean, you realize that your fundamental existence is not just this ego in this skin encapsulating organism. And that's a realization that you'll carry with you. But you won't actually be in that state permanently. And what can happen as you continue to practice and continues to practice is you can continue to actually deepen the amount of time, so to speak, that you're actually in that state. And what will tend to happen there is that you will start to, for example, as your consciousness starts to permanently extend from gross into subtle, the traditions often talk about gross, subtle, and causal states. Examples are given as waking, dreaming, and then deep formal sleep. But most people just identify with the gross waking state. And then when they dream at night, they're unconscious. And certainly when they go into deep dreamless sleep, they're unconscious. But they wake up in the morning and they'll say, oh, I slept pretty well. So they still have this intuition of their true self that continued to exist through all of those states, even though they weren't experiencing that themselves. But if you've had this satori and you're actually practicing these types, some sort of meditative or contemplative practice on a fairly regular basis, then your consciousness itself will actually start to extend into the subtle domain, and it'll tend to just stay there. And so when you go to sleep at night, you'll start lucid dreaming. So you'll be dreaming, but you'll know you're dreaming because you still have that consciousness. You're still aware of that. Now, one of the things that will start to happen is that as you fall asleep, you'll tend to stop identifying with the gross, finite, manifest realm. That just disappears in your sleep state. So one of the things that you'll notice is that you are still yourself. You're still I am-ness. You still have that sense of I am-ness, that pure awareness. But you're not identified with anything in the gross realm. You're not identified with the physical body. You're not in the typical relationship you're in. You don't have the typical job you have. Now you're in this sort of subtle dream state, but you're aware you're there and you still feel this I am-ness. So you know that this I am-ness is nete, the gross realm. It's no longer identified with the gross realm. Now you knew, in a sense, you knew that when you had your first satori, because you realized that you were sort of identified with everything that was arising. But as you continue to expand your enlightened awareness, it's going to continue to stretch into these deeper and deeper states of consciousness. And so if you continue meditating, practicing, often in the empirical studies we have on this shows that it's often about 10 years or longer that people have to seriously practice meditation. And to do that, they're already gone from gross into subtle. So they're already having lucid dreaming. But then when they pass into deep dreamless sleep, They'll also keep a very, very tacit awareness. They'll still know I am. They'll still recognize their fundamental isness, their thusness, their real self is still there. Now, and they'll know now it's not identified with the gross realm. It's not identified with the dream state or the subtle state or anything you can see. Now, absolutely nothing is arising, and you're one with that. So you are getting into that deep, radical freedom type of emptiness sort of state. And that's not something that's going to happen with your first satori. So depending on how you define ego will depend upon when you say it's gone. So if you define ego in just a very loose, superficial way, as just the sense that I'm nothing but this body and I'm nothing but this conventional self, that sense will go away with your first major satori. Because you realize you're not just this anymore, and you'll never forget that realization, and that's true. But your separate self sense is still there. Your ego, in that sense, that's still operating. You'll be interpreting your waking up through that ego, and that ego will probably be telling a lot of people about how enlightened you are. And it's still there, fully functioning, having a good old time. And it takes a fair amount of time to get rid of that little bugger. And if you define it as just being the separate self sense itself, just even a sense of pure witnessing. And by the way, some Zen masters call witnessing absolute subjectivity, because that's what it is. It's a pure subject that can't be an object. But as you continue doing that absolute subjectivity, then there's the second part of enlightenment that we didn't talk about. But the second part of waking up is the pure witness itself dissolves. And there's literally nothing but, well, whatever state you're in, it's just arising all on its own. So if you're in the gross waking state, then when you're no longer the witness, now you're looking at a mountain, but now you no longer see the mountain. Now you are the mountain. And you no longer see the clouds. You are the clouds. And you no longer feel the earth. You are there. So you just radically one with everything that's arising. And that's a much more kind of ultimate. That's a state of non-duality or not two-ness. Subjects and objects are all not two. They're all one. And that's an ultimate oneness type of experience. The witness and oneness are very closely related. And generally, people will experience the witness and then oneness. But they are very closely related. And they're both considered types of enlightenment or waking up experiences. But if you define the ego as just the separate self sense, yeah, including any sort of absolute subjectivity, that doesn't disappear until you're going through all three of those states and you've disidentified with all of those. Then the separate self sense is gone. And that's what would be listed technically as a complete enlightenment. And you'll find some traditions, including aspects of Tibetan Buddhist tradition, that still have a few sort of nuances of understanding in that state as well. So the whole point about waking up is it really is a process. And it's much like growing up in terms of the sophistication and complexity that it has. But the point is that waking up is something that even from the first glimpse you get of an authentic waking up experience, your life has changed. You have profound, profound re-understanding of the world, of your own self, and of what's happening. So it's a very, very profound experience. And you can see why it's common for people who've had that experience to think that they're completely enlightened, because things have so dramatically and genuinely changed.
It's amazing how much of this maps with Jed McKenna's Spiritual Enlightenment, The Damnedest Thing. Are you familiar with that?
Well, I don't know that one specifically. But one of the things that has happened throughout history, and East and West, is there's this big difference between spiritual engagement that occurs in growing up and a spiritual engagement that occurs in waking up. And in waking up, of course, this is more sort of direct, immediate spiritual experience. So we're saying if you have a waking up experience, it's a direct experience. You know it. You're fully aware of it. You're experiencing it. And it's generally some form of awareness or oneness that's occurring. And so if you are feeling just this pure awareness state, and you happen to be a Christian, then that's something that you would feel as Christ consciousness. Not I, but Christ liveth in me. St. Paul said, let this consciousness be in you, which was in Christ Jesus, that we all may be one. And that's another, that's a direct, if you have that experience, that's a direct spiritual experience. That's a satori. That's a genuine metamorphosis. It's a genuine awakening or enlightenment. And so that's the kind of spiritual relationship you have with waking up. Now, in growing up, and this is just a little bit more complicated, but I'll do this quickly. What we found is that there's not just one type of intelligence that human beings have. We actually have upwards of around a dozen types of multiple intelligences. So we don't just have cognitive intelligence. We also have moral intelligence. We have emotional intelligence. We have aesthetic intelligence. We have spatial intelligence. We have verbal intelligence. We have mathematical intelligence. We also have something called spiritual intelligence. Now, spiritual intelligence is simply how you interpret, how you think about some sort of ultimate reality. So that's not necessarily directly experiencing it. So when you're at, again, just to use simple gaps or stages, if you're at a magic stage of development, well, all of these multiple intelligences, they all go through the same major levels of development. So these are different lines of development that go through these major levels of development. So if your spiritual intelligence is moving through a magic level, and most of your other intelligences are too, at the early magic stage of development, or if you're at a magic stage in today's childhood, which is the first 2, 3, 4 years of life, then you're going to interpret ultimate reality as being magical. And something like spiral dynamics, for example, will call this stage power gods. So the young child, 4 years old, will look at mommy and it will think that mommy can change this yucky spinach into candy if she wanted to, because she's a power god. She can do magic. And of course, when you were 1 year old, you thought you could do magic. It was called primary narcissism or word magic. If you just think something, it will happen. Well, that's what your spiritual intelligence, that's the kind of spiritual ultimate reality spiritual intelligence will create then. If you get up to the mythic stage of development, then your spiritual intelligence is going to produce a mythic version of ultimate reality. So here you're going to have things like Zeus and Apollo or Jehovah or Allah or James Fowler, who actually did empirical research on stages of development of people's spiritual intelligence, not mystical experience, but just how they thought about an ultimate reality. He called this stage mythic literal, because that's what it was. People would take the myths as being literally true. So somebody who's at a mythic literal stage and believes in Christianity, they'll believe that Moses really did part the Red Sea, that Lot's wife really was turned into a pillar of salt, that Mary really was a biological virgin, and on. And it's a mythic, literal understanding. And that's the best that our cognitive orientation can do. And so our spiritual intelligence would tend to come from that stage. And then if you move to rational stage of development, then we'll tend to get a rational, and spiritual intelligence is operating rationally. Then you can be, well, you can be an atheist. You can also be a theist. There are rational versions of Christianity. It just doesn't believe the Bible literally, But a lot of the founding fathers, a lot of people in the Western Enlightenment were what was called deists. And deists believed that there was an original mythic being that created the world. And then the world ran on completely rational scientific principles that we can now discover, but it's still all created by a theistic ground of being. And pluralistic stage of spiritual intelligence tends to say, whatever you want to believe, that's your truth. Whatever I want to believe, that's my truth. I believe anything that you define. And then you get the integral, and it starts integrating all of these. And one of the things that we'll often do is look at developmental stages of unfolding. Now, I brought all of this up because one of the things that happened is because mythic literal as a stage of development is so often thought of as a religious state. And when most people think of something, that person's very religious, many people will think, oh, they believe in some sort of, they won't use the term necessarily, but some sort of mythic reality. So they believe in Allah, or they believe in Zeus or Jehovah or whoever it is. And so that was often identified with waking up. And it was also the case that when humanity itself was going through a largely mythic, literal stage of development, which all of the original early great civilizations were, they were all at mythic stages of development. And that's why most of the original mythic religious texts were produced during that period, whether it was the Old Testament itself or the Vedas or any of those. They all were mythic forms taken to be literally true. Well, people were also having waking up experiences then. And so, and they wouldn't tend to distinguish these because nobody understood these growing up stages, as I said, till about 100 years ago. So you just had a waking up. Oh, you've discovered this great ultimate mythic literal, and you're one, you know, with that. Well, what happened with the Western Enlightenment is as the rational stage emerged, people started rejecting the mythic stage as being the arbiter of what's ultimately real. And most of them just said, no, that's just religious stuff. That's not really real. We're scientists. We believe in what's real. You guys are mythic. You guys believe in religion. You're deeply confused. You're childish and idiotic. And, you know, we think you're stupid. So what happened is a lot of certainly mythic literal beliefs were rejected during that rational period. But several leading edge people were still having waking up experiences. But now they were interpreting them in more rational terms. Because as we said, you'll interpret your waking up according to the stage you're growing up you're at. When you're at magic, you'll interpret it magically. When you're at mythic, it's Jehovah and Zeus. When you're rational, it's a rational statement. And so you can be a scientist and have these waking up experiences. And a fair number of the really influential philosophers of that era, people like Schopenhauer, for example, had profound waking up experiences, but they were no longer interpreting them mythically. So what would start to happen is you get a whole shift in what spirituality consists of. And what it no longer consists of is a mythic literal component. That's just childish. And it is experienced by children. But your spirituality, particularly if your spiritual intelligence is it rational or higher, your spiritual intelligence is, and you've had this waking up experience, you're now going to interpret that according to very rational, even scientific terms. So one of the things that you see starting to happen in this modern orange era is people will claim things like modern physics proves mysticism, that modern quantum mechanics is showing a mystical unity of everything. And they write books like The Tao of Physics, and they claim things like Deepak Chopra and all of that. And the only problem with that is quantum mechanics doesn't show you anything like that. Quantum mechanics is a set of very, very dense Schrödinger mathematical equations. And all, if you work all these equations very hard, what all you'll get is the likely location of a single subatomic particle. That's it. It doesn't include biology or chemistry or psychology or sociology. All of those are left out. It's not showing a oneness of all of those. It's not dealing with them at all. And I actually got, I mean, I actually did my graduate studies in a field of biochemistry that used quantum mechanics. And it was really clear to me that this was just a bad interpretation. I understood what they were doing. They were having waking up experiences, and they were interpreting them in rational scientific terms. But it was pretty clear to me that's not what the founders of modern physics did. And so I actually went back and I got pretty much all of the founders of modern quantum and relativistic physics, several dozen of them. And I read everything they'd ever written on physics and spirituality. And I took those writings and put them all together in an anthology that was called Quantum Questions. And it was just, you can just read what Schrödinger and Heisenberg and Eddington and de Broglie and all these people had to say about the new physics they had just discovered and how that related to spirituality. And there were two things that were incredibly, that stood out just unmistakably. And you, the book is still out there. You can get it. It's called Quantum Questions. And it's some beautiful, beautiful, mystical writing. And what you found is that virtually every single one of these founders of modern physics were mystics. And they really had this experience of absolute oneness with everything. And every single one of them explicitly said, I don't think modern physics has anything to do with any of that. And Eddington even said, for example, for my own part, I am wholly opposed to such attempts. And they were opposed to it because it was profoundly confusing, the different methodologies that you had to use to get to these two domains. I mean, if it was really true that quantum mechanics showed the same reality as you get on Enlightenment, then every physicist, every modern physicist in existence would have to have had an Enlightenment experience as he or she got their degree in quantum mechanics. Almost none of them have. I mean, again, the only thing you'll actually get if you learn quantum mechanics is an education on extremely difficult differential equations that were founded by Erwin Schrödinger. And Schrödinger, by the way, was a profound mystic, and particularly of the Vedanta variety. And you can find some of the most beautiful mystical writings are from Erwin Schrödinger, and those are included in quantum mechanics. So the whole point is simply that you mentioned this one spiritual approach. And this was just a way of saying that a lot of the types of spiritual approaches that we have in today's world, particularly where people themselves have developed into orange or green or second tier, and their cognitive intelligence, the moral intelligence, their spiritual intelligence is at those world-centric or higher stages, is that they won't use mythic literal material. It's just not part of what they find true or real. But they real often come up with rational, sort of scientific, oh, this is a new paradigm. And all the new paradigms in science are showing the oneness of everything, and so on and so on. And that's fine. What we don't want to do is confuse those so badly that people think that if they just read a book that says quantum mechanics proves physicism, that it's the same as having a waking up experience, because it's not. And if you think you've already got that covered, then you're never going to have an enlightenment experience. It's just going to hold you back from that. So we don't want to go that far. They were actually stopping people from pursuing a path that will actually give them an enlightenment or awakening experience. And that's what's happening for some people.
There's this thought I've been having lately about people's desire for certainty and to know things for sure one way or another. And we talked about this earlier, kind of moving up the levels, how people, I suppose at the orange level, need things to be quantizable
so they can have measurable, so they can have certainty about it. And so often in these discussions, I bring up the double slit experiment to just kind of allude to an idea that it might not be possible to describe all of reality through the orange level. But I'm not exactly sure what that alludes to once they discover it doesn't describe everything. It doesn't seem to me that, that's a gateway to green or something like that.
Right. Well, no. One of the things that is certainly the more mystically oriented founders of modern physics is that if you look at the great mystical traditions, East and West, and you don't have to have a mystical experience to have this realization. Other types of individuals, rational philosophers and so on, have had sort of this essentially similar type of realization. But you get it almost all the time with mystical discipline. And that is that the world is, and this a la Nagarjuna, everything I'm about to say would be called X. And ultimate reality is neither X nor non-X nor both nor neither. So I'm talking metaphorically in that sense. This isn't a literal description that we can just take. But the general notion in a metaphoric sense is that there is a ground of being and that it's fully present at every single point of space and time. You said all of infinity is right here. All of eternity is right now. And that ground of all being has thrown itself outward to create a manifest universe. And it's done this innumerable number of times. I mean, the Big Bang 14 billion years ago, that's just the most recent time. It'll go outward and then collapse and then do it all over. And that's just what happens in the world of space-time. But when it does throw itself outward in a motion that's generally called involution, Plotinus called it efflux, because this infinite reality is throwing itself outward into a finite manifest world. Well, in any sort of manifest world, it's a world of opposites. I mean, even our concepts, every concept we use makes sense in terms of its opposite. Does good versus evil, pleasure versus pain, up versus down, in versus out. I mean, it's just this world of opposites. And the reality, and then we tend to try to just get all the good opposites together and put all the bad opposites over here and get rid of those. And that's what our life is in this illusory stream of time, is we're juggling opposites. And so the mystics will often, just to point you in a different direction, will often call that ultimate truth, that ultimate reality, with names like non-duality, meaning it's not two, it's not opposites. The Christian mystics actually call it coincidentia oppositorum, the coincidence of opposites, the unity of opposites. Alan Watts actually wrote a book called The Two Hands of God. In other words, God has a left hand and a right hand, and that's the manifest universe, opposites. But God himself isn't left or right. So that's, in a sense, a kind of profound mystical realization. And even though, again, it's not a direct description of ultimate reality, you only know ultimate reality when you have that immediate experience yourself, then that's ultimate reality. But it is this coincidental oppositorum. And it catches people up who are used to just living in this world of opposites. And they know that all they want is like they want more pay, not less pay. They want an attractive spouse, not an unattractive spouse. They want to live in a good neighborhood, not a bad neighborhood. They want to have bright kids. They don't want to have stupid kids. They're living in this world of opposites. And all they want to do is separate the opposites and get the good ones and get rid of the bad ones. And then all of a sudden, you hear somebody come along and say, well, that's fine. It just doesn't work in a fundamental ultimate level. Because what we think of as like a wave or a particle, they actually are both true. And this is much more a matter of your own perspective than it is a matter of any sort of fundamental reality. But that's just not what's real. And we can prove it to you with scientific experiments if you want. And that was taken But a lot of these sort of mystical physicists, as simply one of the more obvious sort of remnants, if you will, of this ultimate two-handed God that had manifested the entire universe out of its oneness, its not two-ness, its left and right-handed togetherness. And this is just a little leftover ingredient of that, showing that kind of thing. And then you can find it in other areas, like if you actually analyze the way thoughts operate, or, I mean, you can even be a philosopher like Hegel, and then you'll see evolution itself moving from a thesis to an antithesis to a synthesis, and then it splits into opposites, and those opposites come together into a higher unit. So all of Hegel's dialectic is a coming together of opposites at higher and higher levels. It's a coincidentia oppositorum. And that's been a fairly widespread view among a large number of the really brightest philosophers, again, East and West. So there are a lot of areas you can look for that kind of coincidentia oppositorum. And the wave particle one, certainly one on a physics level.
All right, that was part four of our interview with Ken Wilber. We've just got one more week left where we talk about the potential flaws of integral theory and the flaws of major spiritual teachings. To get all the links and show notes for this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/113 and stay tuned for the finale of this interview.
Enter the Future Thinkers giveaway and win our brand new community membership, including in-depth courses, private calls, and more, as well as a supply of Qualia, a complete cognitive upgrade for your brain. To enter the contest, simply go to futurethinkers.org/giveaway and sign up for our mailing list to instantly get our 50-page guide on how to adapt to the future. There are many ways to increase your chances of winning. Enter the competition today. The brand new Future Thinkers members portal is now live. Develop your sovereignty and self-knowledge with our in-depth courses, get access to our weekly sense-making calls, join the Q&As with past podcast guests, and much more. Become a Future Thinkers member today at futurethinkers.org/members. To stay up to date with new episodes, subscribe to Future Thinkers on your favorite platform. And leave us a review or a like. It really helps out the show. And don't forget to share this episode on social media.